Now, Dr. Burt now will discuss the rationale, background, and methodology for hematopoietic stem cell transplantation. Dr. Richard Burt is an associate professor of medicine and the chief of the autoimmune division at Northwestern, and he's become an international star in this new therapy, and I'm delighted to be collaborating with him. Richard?
Thank you, Dr. Craig. Dr. Craig is a colleague and a friend and a gentleman to work with, and I want to thank him and the AGA for inviting us to talk about this today. So I just want to give you a little bit about the background of what we're doing. We're really trying to attempt two things with these stem cells. One is induction of tolerance. Tolerance means different things to different people. It means something different in our immunology lab, where we're talking about antigen-specific unresponsiveness. In the patient, however, tolerance to me is clinical tolerance. That's what's important. And that means there's no signs or symptoms of disease with the patient on no immune suppressive medications at all, and normal responsiveness to infections or third-party antigens. So that's what we're shooting for, is clinical tolerance, using stem cell as a therapy for to achieve clinical tolerance. The second issue is regeneration of tissue. Now, there's been a lot of lay press about embryonic stem cells and their ability to regenerate and repair damaged tissues. I think there's great promise there. There's also controversy and ethical issues. One of the interesting things is that perhaps the adult blood stem cell has that capacity to form non-blood tissue, to form epithelial tissue, to form liver, to form gut. And we'll discuss that a little bit. So about 13 years ago, we started working in animal models, back when I was at the National Institutes of Health, to see if blood stem cell transplant could induce tolerance in animal models of autoimmune disease. The models we worked with were models for MS, basically. And now more recently, our lab has moved into working with animal blood stem cells, as well as animal, not human, but animal embryonic stem cells, murine embryonic stem cells, to look at this issue of regeneration of tissue. This is an EM of a stem cell here on the right. Must be female, it's pink. No, I'm just teasing. Anyway, what is the rationale for this? It really began back in the early 80s when there were several investigators, and predominantly the investigator was Professor Ikahara in Japan, who pushed this field, showing that allogeneic hematopoietic stem cell transplants, HSCT is hematopoietic stem cell transplants, could cure animals with these diseases that were like SLE, or were diabetes. Now, that never really took off in the clinical field, and the reason is the toxicity of allogeneic transplants and the associated graft versus host disease. It was considered too morbid a therapy for a patient with an autoimmune disorder, and I agree with that, so it went nowhere. But then in the 1990s, there were several experiments by several investigators, and several people that did this were Van Beckham in the Netherlands, myself here in America, in Shimon Slavin in Jerusalem, and what they showed is that you could use syngeneic, pseudoautologous, or autologous stem cells to cure these two animal autoimmune diseases. AA is adjuvant arthritis. It's an animal model for rheumatoid arthritis. EAE is experimental autoimmune encephalomyelitis. It's an animal model for MS. Now, syngeneic means from a genetically identical mouse that doesn't have the disease. Autologous means, of course, coming from that mouse that you're doing the transplant in. The problem with doing an autologous transplant in a mouse is the way we get the stem cells is you amputate the femur and wash the cells out of the femur. So it's hard to actually do an autologous because then you'd have a mouse with an amputated leg, and I'm not sure I'd want to do that or IRB would ethically approve such a procedure. Nevertheless, some people around the world have done that. Most people, then, if they really want to do autologous, would do pseudo-autologous. So they take a syngeneic strain of mice. The donor, then, is the syngeneic animal that has disease at the same stage as the recipient. And you collect the marrow from them, and that's called pseudo-autologous. Well, why does autologous work for AA and EAE? Whereas back in the 80s, they showed that you had to use allogeneic from a non-disease susceptible strain to cure lupus and diabetes. It turns out that in some animal autoimmune diseases, such as the SLE models in the NOD mouse, non-obese diabetic mouse, it occurs spontaneously. Whether you do anything to the animal or not, they develop this disease. And it appears to be really genetically pre-programmed, fairly independent of the environment. In other animal autoimmune diseases, such as adjuvant arthritis and experimental autoimmune encephalomyelitis, you have to do something environmentally to induce the disease. And what you do is you immunize them. In AA, you just use an adjuvant. In EAE, you immunize them with an adjuvant that contains a protein found in myelin, a small peptide found in myelin. And you induce a disease that mimics MS, both clinically and histologically. So these are induced environmentally, and they can be cured with an autologous stem cell transplant. These appear to occur independent of the environment, SLE and diabetes, and you need an allogeneic to cure them. Well, the question is, since autologous is so much safer than allogeneics, which are human autoimmune diseases? Are they genetically pre-programmed and they're going to occur independent of the environment? Or is it predominantly environmental in a susceptible host? And I think that, you know, verdict is out. Nobody can answer that for sure. But looking at identical twins for concordance of disease, what you find in virtually all autoimmune disease, whether it's diabetes or SLE or rheumatoid arthritis or multiple sclerosis, is the concordance rates, depending on the paper, run from 25 to 50%. On an average, about 33%, a third are concordant for the disease. And the other genetically identical, syngeneic, identical twin does not have the autoimmune disease and doesn't appear to develop it, despite the fact they have very similar, not exactly identical, but very similar environmental exposures. That suggests that perhaps in most human autoimmune diseases, an autologous stem cell transplant may induce a durable remission. Will they relapse? Possibly. Maybe a prediction would be one-third would relapse, since the concordance rate among identical twins is about a third. We don't know. But this opened the door to try it. Autologous stem cell transplants in severe autoimmune diseases. Now, more recently, beginning around 2000, and there's been several papers in Science and Nature, it's been discovered that in the mouse, the adult mouse hematopoietic stem cell found in the bone marrow may differentiate into non-blood tissue. So it can be pushed both ex vivo and in vivo to form a hepatocyte or gut epithelial cell or a muscle cell or what looks like a neuronal-like cell. Whether that occurs in human beings or not is controversial. Even this data in animals is controversial. Some labs haven't confirmed it, but several labs have confirmed this finding. And so it changes the old paradigm again, the old dogma. It was always thought that the only stem cell that could really switch to another tissue compartment was the embryonic stem cell, and that's been long lost in adults, and that may not be the case. I think the verdict's still out on that. So I just wanted to show you some data, and this is really a summary of data, mostly from Van Beckham in the Netherlands, but also from myself, looking at autologous stem cell transplants in animal models, in which here are rats treated for adjuvant arthritis, a model for RA, mice for experimental autoimmune encephalomyelitis, a model of MS, rats again for this model of MS, and rats for a model here, myasthenia gravis, experimental autoimmune myasthenia gravis down at the bottom. And what you can see, it's you can induce remissions in 100%. Spontaneous relapse was very rare, and it wasn't any different whether you use allogeneic or syngeneic in most cases, although down in this system with rats, it was less with allogeneic than autologous. When you try to induce the disease in these animals, remember, the way these animals get disease is by environmentally inducing it, that is, immunizing them with self-epitopes or with adjuvant. You can see that they're fairly refractory to reinduction. Again, allogeneic, less than autologous, but this is less than what we would have suspected. And so those are kind of encouraging results to try these clinical trials in patients with severe autoimmune diseases. Is there clinical evidence now to support this? Before I talk about our patients with Crohn's, and as Dr. Craig mentioned, we've done four, and the longest is now 12 months out, let's look at some other data that exists. Now, obviously, every autoimmune disease is different. We're very much aware of that. We design our trials and selection of patients and stem cells and conditioning regimen in following the patients based on their disease. So everyone's different. What I want to show you is a little bit of data. And at Northwestern, we have these protocols ongoing or about to start for several diseases. Crohn's disease, our first patient a year ago. Lupus, we did our first patient 5 years ago. Rheumatoid arthritis 5 years ago. Multiple sclerosis 5 years ago. Pemphigus, we just got FDA approval to do this. All our protocols go through the US FDA, and we must stand up to that scrutiny before we can start the trial. Scleroderma, our protocol's just approved. Myasthenia gravis, the protocol's just been submitted to our IRB. And type 1 diabetes, the draft of the protocol's just written. Well, it turns out we designed the same conditioning regimen, that is the regimen to try to, quote, ablate the immune system before we infuse the stem cell for Crohn's and lupus. And since we now have 5 years' experience with lupus, I just want to very briefly touch on that. Stem cell transplants for lupus at Northwestern, 5 years of work, 15 patients, we're now up to 19, and we have them stacked in a holding pattern over O'Hare, getting quite a few referrals. The leader of our lupus program is Dr. Ann Trainer, who's my colleague and who's done a phenomenal job on this. And this has laid the groundwork for a phase three trial, which has already been designed. Remember, this initial study was a phase one study. Here's the first 15 patients, and I just briefly touch on it. We could talk all day on these results, but here's proteinuria. And again, we took patients who failed everything. So they have refractory disease, and they've failed all therapy out there. And what we found is that there's a marked improvement in this proteinuria, and sometimes it can take here, you know, 3-6 months before you start seeing it get better. And it just continually improves gradually over time, despite the fact they're off all immune suppressive medications, which we have to gradually taper off over about 6 to 8 months, because many of these patients come in on 60, 80, 100 milligrams of prednisone a day, which they've been on for years. But we've seen tremendous improvement. Here's another organ system which surprised us, and that's pulmonary. Now, lupus does involve the lung, or can, and when it does, it's a very severe complication. As a matter of fact, our second transplant was a patient who had alveolar hemorrhage secondary to lupus. Each episode of alveolar hemorrhage has a 50% mortality, and she was referred to us by Creighton University with her second episode within 2 months, went through transplant, 3 years out, no evidence of lupus at all now. But what we were surprised by is here, when we started looking at lung function, we could have just as well done DLCO, but here's forced vital capacity, pre-transplant and then following them post-transplant, and this goes out now to almost 5 years, you can see marked continued improvement. And that started us thinking, why are they getting better? We thought if this would work, it would stop further destruction, but why do they get better? We don't expect scarring to disappear, but we're nevertheless seeing improvement. And perhaps the organ itself is improving from a stem cell compartment within the organ, or perhaps it's the blood stem cells that are pushing them towards improvement. And that's an issue I will come back to later. We also look at the immunology of these patients. Here's by CDR3 spectrotype analysis, V-beta 1 through 24 in a pre-transplant lupus patient. It's a very skewed repertoire. Here's a normal CDR3 spectrotype analysis from a normal individual. 9 months post-transplant, not quite normal, but markedly improved diversity compared to the pre-transplant sample. And whatever parameter we looked at, we've seen this marked normalization of the immune system in these lupus patients. And what that's led to is an NIH-funded phase three trial that I'm the PI on that we anticipate to start in 2002, but maybe 2003. And that is now in awaiting a pre-IND with the FDA. Okay, so we talked about clinical evidence for this approach in autoimmune diseases as well as animals for inducing tolerance. What about the stem cell regeneration of damaged tissue? There was not enough time today to talk about the animal work, so I'm not going to do that. I'm going to talk, is there any human evidence that the human blood stem cell, not embryonic, but the stem cell in your bone marrow can repair other organs. So it doesn't just differentiate into the neutrophil and the monocyte and the macrophage and the T cell and the B cell and the NK cell or the red blood cell or the platelet, but it can actually form liver or gut or muscle or some other. And this, I think, is very questionable, but I want to show you some data, and this data was shared with me 6 months ago from the investigators at MD Anderson, and it was recently published, New England Journal of Medicine, March 7th issue. Korbling is the first author from MD Anderson. And what they did, and so these are actually slides from that article, what they did is they, to try to look at this, is they looked at patients who had an allogeneic transplant, that is a stem cell transplant from their brother, could have been their sister, but they looked at women who had a transplant from their brother, so their sex mismatched, and it was for some malignancy, lymphoma, leukemia, myeloma, whatever. They had taken biopsies to rule out graft versus host disease, and they had saved those biopsies in paraffin sections so they could have been months to years old, and they went back and they took those paraffin sections and they looked at them to determine if any of those epithelial cells were male. These are female patients. They had a stem cell bone marrow or peripheral blood stem cell transplant from their brother. Their control, where they went back to paraffin sections on female patients who had a stem cell transplant from their sister. Well, in every single patient they looked at in which the donor was a sister, all the epithelial cells were female, as you'd expect. You'd also expect if the donor was a male that the epithelial cells in that recipient would still be female. So here's skin. That's an H&E of skin in this A section right here. So you can see it's skin. And over here they stained it in this B section with an antibody to CD45, which shows up in any blood cell. And so these could be blood cells. These others are not, so they want to show that they're not blood cells. This is a stain for cytokeratin, so obviously it's skin, stains very darkly. Now, this is fluorescence in situ hybridization for the centromere region of the X and Y chromosome, and if it's X, it'll be this kind of blue color, and if it's male, it'll be red. And so you can see this cell, which is blown up right here, has an X and a Y chromosome. It's an epithelial cell in the skin. It's a skin cell that is male in this female patient. On these bottom slides, they stained for cytokeratin, and then they also did in situ hybridization to show with the two stains that this is a male skin cell. Now, this is liver, H&E of liver, CD45 stain. These are not blood cells, a stain for hepatocytes. And again, you can see here's the Y and here's the X chromosome. So this, and double stain here, you can see that this hepatocyte is male. Now here's a biopsy you probably all recognize of the GI tract. So this is gut, H&E, CD45 stain, no blood cells in there, stain for epithelial cells, and then you can see again in situ fluorescent hybridization, the X and the Y chromosome. So some of these, and here they show three of them, are male cells. In pretty much every paraffin section, they found male cells in every patient in which the donor was male and the recipient female, and sometimes up to 7%, which could be clinically quite useful. So again, this is retrospective. It wasn't a prospective design study, but it's very interesting. It goes along with some murine work that's been done. And now in our lab, what we're doing is we're looking at repair of tissues, comparing the murine bone marrow or a blood stem cell to the murine embryonic stem cell. Well, that's kind of the background. Let's talk about the methodology of doing these stem cell transplants. And there's kind of three phases to this. One is we have to mobilize these stem cells. That is, we have to collect them from the patient. The old way of doing it is mostly from the bone marrow, and we don't do that anymore. We get them from the peripheral blood just because it's more convenient. The other is then once we get those cells out of the peripheral blood, most of them are not progenitor or, quote, stem cells. And so we have to enrich for the stem cell, which has a marker on it called CD34. So these progenitor cells are CD34 positive, and we can enrich for them in the laboratory. We then freeze them down, and then we go back and give the patient the, quote, immunoablative conditioning regimen, and immediately after that, almost immediately afterwards, infuse those stem cells in the hope of, quote, resetting the immune system. Now, here's this blood stem cell. You can see it's a very large nucleus, small cytoplasm, open nuclear formation, and large nucleoli can be confused with a blast in a patient with leukemia. And indeed, these immature stem cells are kind of like a blast in that sense. They're very immature cells that we all have. We can collect them from the bone marrow or, as I mentioned, from the peripheral blood. Now, normally, they don't circulate in our peripheral blood to any degree that is clinically useful or that is worth detecting them. There's probably a very minute number that are normally there, but it's very, very, very small. So we have to do something to get them from the bone marrow into the peripheral blood, and we use a cytokine, GCSF. We've found and have reported that GCSF may flare certain autoimmune diseases like multiple sclerosis. It may not for Crohn's. It may actually be beneficial. We don't know. But if we use the combination of cyclophosphamide and GCSF, which is synergistic and pushes more stem cells in the peripheral blood, there is no flare. There's some amelioration improvement in the autoimmune disorders, and that's our standard mobilizing regimen for autoimmune disorders to collect the stem cells. So we give them Cytoxan and GCSF, and about 10 days later, we collect the stem cells. And the reason we have to do that is wait for the nadir from the Cytoxan, which is about 1 day, and on the rebound is when the stem cells get pushed into peripheral blood with the help of the growth factor, and we collect those cells, take them to the lab, and we enrich for the stem cell. There's really two commercially available, and now there's actually a third one in this country, instruments for doing this, Isolex and Miltenyi. Isolex is used most in America, Miltenyi in Europe. You could really use either. In our trial, we used Isolex and basically used an antibody to bind the CD34 antigen and another antibody to capture that antibody-bound cell and pull it off. Isolex using a paramagnetic bead, and then you can release them later after they've been enriched. And you get about a 4-log depletion of lymphocytes from the product that way. Now, what's our immune conditioning regimen? We've collected the cells, we've enriched them, we've frozen them down. And really, the regimen we give patients is designed on experience in malignancies and animal models of autoimmune diseases, AID. And the most common regimen being used worldwide for any autoimmune disease is cyclophosphamide and ATG. That's the regimen we used in lupus, and I showed you the results. This is 200 milligrams per kilogram, so it's big gun cyclophosphamide. And that's the regimen we chose to use in Crohn's disease. It's not the regimen we used in MS. There's different reasons why we do things differently for each disease. But in any event, here's our regimen for Crohn's disease. Cytoxan, 50 milligrams per kilogram on day minus 5, minus 4, minus 3, minus 2. Day 0 is the day of infusion of stem cells. ATG, day minus 4, 3, and 2. Selumetrol, which is 1 gram, is given to prevent serum sickness from ATG. It's given a half an hour before the ATG, and then stem cells are infused on day 0. What's our selection criteria? Age less than 60. The younger a patient is, the easier they tolerate a procedure like this. They must have failed prednisone, azathioprine, 5-ASA products, flagellin, anti-TNF therapy. And what do we mean by failure? They must have a Crohn's disease activity index between 250 and 400, despite this therapy. Our phase 1 trial goes to 10 patients. We have enrolled 5. We've actually completed stem cell mobilization on 4. I put 5 here because I thought we would have done the 5th by today, but we've done it, completed it on 4. The number of transplants that have been completed are 3. The 4th patient is in-house and is, I think, day 7 or 8. Both Dr. Craig and I talked to her by phone yesterday. She's doing great. Post-transplant follow-up is done at set intervals, and we now have 12 months, 11 months, and this should be 1 month follow-up on the 3 patients that have completed this treatment. Here's our very first patient. I just wanted to show you this colonoscopy picture because it really shows how bad the disease is, these serpiginous ulcers and this marked edema and inflammation. And the colon is so swollen and narrowed that Dr. Craig could not advance the colonoscope any further. This was a 22-year-old female, 10-year duration of this disease, severe Crohn's disease, diarrhea 25 to 30 times a day, sometimes bloody. Severe pain, so severe that she was on continuous infusion narcotics, Dilaudid at 3 milligrams per hour, had been on it for over 2 years. TPN for 2 years. She had a partial ileal and colon resection in the past. Her Crohn's disease activity index when she came to us was 305, so she was very sick. Severe colitis, ileitis on colonoscopy and small bowel x-rays. Our second patient was similar. We do the transplants in a HEPA-filtered room. HEPA stands for High Efficiency Particle Air Filtration. It removes fungus and bacteria from the air. In fact, the whole floor at Northwestern is HEPA filtered, so they can get up, walk around, do whatever they want to do. But you need at least a HEPA filtered room if your floor you're doing this on, hospital floor, is not HEPA filtered. The conditioning regimen, as I mentioned, takes about a week, and then stem cells are infused day 0. About 10 days after infusing stem cells, your white blood cells engraft. That is, they rebound up over 1,000 from virtually nothing, and you're home free in terms of acute bacterial infections. We anticipate that they'll require some red blood cell and platelet transfusions during this interval. That's normal. And their platelets usually come back between day 10 to 14, so they no longer require platelet transfusions. And we usually discharge about 14 days after stem cell infusion. We evaluate the response at 6 months, 12 months, and yearly for 5 years in these patients. Actually, in the first 2, we had it set at like 1, 3, 6 months, and it was just too much because the patients come from out of state, and so we had the protocol amended to get rid of the early evaluations because they were doing so well. What about the toxicity? Well, the first 3 patients that have completed this procedure had 48 hours of culture-negative fever. That was it. besides requiring some platelet and red blood cell transfusions, which we anticipate. During the procedure, they had resolution in pain. So before they were discharged, their pain and diarrhea was gone. It's not returned in any of the patients. And Dr. Craig will talk about that next. Our fourth patient, who's in-house now, 2 days ago spiked one fever and has remained culture negative and afebrile since then. So these have gone very easily. But I want to caution you, because we started 5 years ago in other diseases such as MS and lupus, and you know, success has many fathers and failures an orphan. And what happens is that a lot of people start doing this, and you have to be very careful in designing these trials, in that it's very easy to use a much more aggressive regimen than what we did. As a transplanter, as a stem cell transplanter, that's my background, this is a very light regimen. For someone dealing with Crohn's disease, this is a very aggressive regimen. Nevertheless, I've seen in some of the other autoimmune diseases where other centers get a little carried away with even more aggressive regimens before we've accumulated data, kind of the concept of, you know, this works, let's use more, and then you get into toxicity with the patient. Even in some of the other autoimmune diseases at other centers, there's been some mortality, so you have to be very careful in how you do this. Nevertheless, if you have experience, if you have colleagues across traditional divisions that can work very well together as we do, these can be extremely boring procedures for the patient. All right, I'm going to turn the disease follow-up over to Professor Craig. Thank you.
Thanks, Richard. I just wanted to underscore what Richard indicated in his last couple of sentences. I'm not an oncologist, and during those 5 days of leukopenia, which Christy's going through right now, I called her yesterday to see how she's doing, I sweat bullets. I mean, these patients have 100 white counts for 5 days, and platelet counts that require transfusions. And if you're an oncologist, you deal with this all the time, but it's something that I find very disturbing.